another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream.
Hi, this is Jack Spirko with yet another edition of the Survival Podcast. One man's view of the world and the changes that are affecting all of us, dictated on a 50-mile commute. This happens to be a morning commute. Beautiful 82-degree morning in sunny Dallas, Texas. I'm sure it's going to be a miserable 97, 98-degree day by the end of the day. I don't know if I'll get an afternoon show in or not today, but either way, we're going to talk about some interesting things today. The main topic that I want to talk about today is biofuels. And not really biofuels as a whole, because there is some, I guess it's a hope for the biofuel industry. Well, I want to talk about what I consider the biofuel pig right now, ethanol and corn-based ethanol. I want to kind of give you guys some facts and figures and some reality checks behind what we're doing with our ethanol program and some of the things that nobody wants to tell you about. The things that you kind of, the information's out there, it just kind of gets buried at the bottom, or, you know, the only people you get it straight from is a blogger or a small publisher. But anyway, before I do that, I want to talk about two things that are going on right now that are very indicative of the market and the U.S. economy. And I think both of these things are going to be seen as something good. They're going to be spun as something good. Short term, they are going to help prop up what's been a dwindling United States stock market. They may help kind of push it towards some gains moving toward the election, which will enable both of our American Bubis Americanus that are running as Democrat and Republican to say, look, see, it's really not that bad. The end of the world's not here. But in reality, they're both indicators of very, very bad things. Number one. Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae. This is early Monday morning, if you got up this morning, turned on the CNN news or Fox News or anything like that, you probably heard about this. But what's happened is the Federal Reserve System came out Sunday evening, just like they did with Bear Stearns, by the way, and said, "Hey, we're gonna help solve this thing. We're gonna prop this thing up. We're not gonna let the two largest issuers of mortgage in the United States go under," which both Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were on the verge of bankruptcy until this move was made. Now, how big are these guys? How deep do their fingers run? Well, odds are, if you have a mortgage, you have a 50-50 shot national average of being either a mortgage borrowed from Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. That's how big they are. Now, what is the federal government going to do, or the Federal Reserve, I'm sorry, not the government, the Federal Reserve, a private banking institution that controls our money supply, going to do? Number one, they said, we're going to let Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae borrow money directly from the Fed, and pay the discount rate. And we're going to open up the floodgates, so to speak, and give them whatever they need kind of to pull them through this tough time. So basically, they give them an infusion of capital, okay? Which means, once again, the Fed is firing up the printing presses, metaphorically and actually realistically this time, and just printing more money. Remember, you might want to listen if you haven't heard my podcast on the M3 money supply. That big infusion of capital, yeah, that'll be part of M3 that's not published anymore, so we won't see how much growth that puts into U.S. dollar inventory. What we have to understand, though, is right now that the two entities themselves have a combined debt of $500 billion. And they're $500 billion in debt. And the way they've been able to turn that debt over at a tune of about $40 to $50 million a month, it's been with investors. And their stocks were doing relatively well for a long time. It seemed like a pretty safe bet. These guys issue mortgages to people with decent credit scores. Not, you know, they don't do subprime. They do, you know, not A paper, but they do good loans. And like I say, are all A paper loans, come to think of it. And then they're backed by the federal government. The federal government backs a portion of every loan issued by Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae, designed to get the American consumer into their first home. That's really what these institutions are all about, helping people buy that normally wouldn't be able to buy, by not giving loans to people with poor credit, but giving loans to people who didn't have a big down payment. That's the big issue here. And but they're $500 billion in debt. So the Fed's going to give them a bunch of money, but that's just going to grow their debt. So you can see that growing debt is not good for a company. And then the other thing that the Fed said is, you know what we'll do? We'll buy some shares. We'll buy some of your stock, right, to prop up your equity if that's what it takes. Think about that for a second. They're going to buy shares of a company that they were able to, with one announcement, drive the price up in. So basically what I think the Fed's doing here is they're setting up a place for themselves to be able to control exactly when they buy in and exactly when they dump their shares. As they push the stock of these two companies back up, they're actually going to make a ton of money off of the American people that buy, you know, stock through mutual funds. As investors tend to go back to these things after the Fed pops them up. So, as you can see, I'm not going to do an in-depth analysis of this, but that's it's kind of a mess right there. And what you're going to see is the stock market's already beginning to rebound. It's not even opening up. The futures for the stock market are up. So we're going to see an up day. We're going to see some up times ahead for the stock market. A lot of it's going to be fueled by this. Then there's another big financial announcement today. And if you're an American who likes good old-fashioned American beer, it just doesn't get any more American than Anheuser-Busch, makers of Budweiser. Well, your beer's fixing to become a Belgian beer, because InBev, a Belgian brewer, is buying Budweiser for $52 billion. Now, that's driven up the price of Budweiser. It's shown confidence, quote-unquote, in the American market. There's a foreign company's coming in and buying one of our biggest icons. And so that's going to help rebound the market a little bit, too. Not anywhere near the way that the Freddie Mac Fannie Mae bailout is, but it is going to help rebound the market. And so, you know, people look at that and say, well, that's a good thing. I'm tired of seeing the market go down. Well, yeah, okay, here's what I see just happened. I'm watching a European company look over and go, okay, who's making money over there? And it turns out, well, Budweiser makes money because people drink when times are good, people drink when times are bad. Let's look, let's figure this out. The $52 billion company, when you convert that to euros, it's 32 billion euros. It's like a $20 billion discount. So all I'm seeing is a company that does business in a very strong foreign currency coming over and buying a profitable but somewhat weakened company because of the weak American dollar. And I just wonder how many more of those things are going to come to pass. So those are just two financially troubling things that your media is going to paint a rosy picture of for you. So just think about that. Wanted to throw a little variety in today, but now let's go into some of the issues with biofuels. So what do we got out of the biofuels market? What is the what are the big issues there? I want to be clear. There are some potential biofuels that I think are going to be useful, especially in the biodiesel world, which takes a lot less energy to create. Unfortunately for us in America, we don't have very many diesel vehicles, so we need something that's more like gasoline, and that happens to be ethanol. But ethanol is not an analog to gasoline. It's not just like gasoline. I'm going to break down some ways that it's not, some of the problems that we have right now with producing corn-based ethanol. Before I do that, I think a lot of people aren't really aware of what ethanol really is. Ethanol is basically alcohol. They don't want to tell you that. It's basically moonshine. And this is the way you make ethanol. You take a grain like corn, and you heat it to a specific temperature, and you hold it there for a while. This is called mashing your grain. Anybody who brews beer would be familiar with this process. You do that for long enough, and what happens is, see, corn's mostly a starch. It doesn't start out as a sugar, so it does a starch. So what happens is, just like if you take a saltine cracker, stick it in your mouth, and suck on it for a while, the saliva in your mouth will convert the starch to sugar, and it'll still go from being like this starchy taste to a sweet taste. If you hold corn or most grains at a temperature, the right temperature for a long enough period of time, that conversion process happens. Now think about it, you just expended heat to do this stuff. Once it turns into sugar, you then inject a yeast into the mash, or wort, as it's called in beer making, and the yeast begins to consume the sugar, okay? And that's called fermentation. And after a certain amount of fermentation, you have most of the sugar is consumed and you're left with alcohol. But you also have a lot of other residual products. If you carbonate this stuff, you end up with beer. That's what beer basically is. It's grain, mashed, converted by yeast, and then, you know, filtered or allowed to settle out and then carbonated from one form or another carbonation. But if you want to make whiskey, if you want to make high alcohol content, more than, you know, the 4 or 5% you get out of beer, you got to get rid of all that excess water. So there's a distillation process where, again, it's heated and the water is basically boiled off, and the alcohol is left behind. And the more water you boil off, the higher your proof. Okay, so that's what it is being regular Bacardi at 80 proof, and that Bacardi 151 that, you know, you could run a jet plane with is. It's just how much of the water is removed and how, leaving how high the concentration of alcohol behind is. That's how they make ethanol out of corn. There's some things that are a little bit different, but it's the basic process. So you got to think about it. There's a lot of heat involved there to produce this stuff. So it's not just like you throw some corn in a thing and mix it up, and a couple days later you pull ethanol out of it. It's not purely a chemical process. There's a lot of energy expended. And even without counting the energy at first, how much corn does it take to produce a gallon of ethanol? It takes about 400 pounds of corn to make a gallon of ethanol. Let me say that again. 400 pounds of corn. Another way to look at this and really get it through your head is it takes about 11 acres of corn to supply fuel for 1 year for the average American driver. 11 acres. That could be generating food for people, which is what it used to do before we started using it to make ethanol. Another problem altogether. But, you know, the average American lot today, housing lot, is somewhere between a tenth and a quarter of an acre. Now, just think about, you know, you probably know what your yard is, so think about that, and if it's a tenth of an acre, think of 10 houses on your street, okay? Now, after you have that, you're going to do that 11 times. That's how much land it takes to grow enough corn to make enough ethanol to run your car for 1 year, all right? What does that mean? That means that it would take an awful lot of our land to produce enough ethanol to run our country. The estimate is 97% of our land would have to be turned into agricultural land growing corn. There's problems with that even if we wanted to do it, that I'll explain here in a bit. The next thing we have to understand about ethanol is you have to transport this stuff with a truck. Now, you've probably seen a lot of fuel trucks in your life. You go to the gas station, there's a big giant truck pumping fuel into the ground, right? Into the tanks in the ground. You go, wow, okay, that's how they get the gas here. But what I want to ask you is, have you ever been out on the interstate in the middle of nowhere, kind of like going from one city to another out through the great, beautiful countryside that we have, and seen an entire convoy of biofuel or fuel trucks, you know, gasoline trucks? The answer is no, you've never seen that. I guarantee you've never seen, you know, 100 fuel trucks lined up cruising down our interstate going from, let's say, you know, Dallas, Texas to Lincoln, Nebraska. And you wonder, well, why is that? You know, how does the fuel get from Dallas, Texas to Lincoln, Nebraska? Well, it never goes from Dallas, Texas to Lincoln, Nebraska because we don't refine fuel here. But if it did, it would go through pipelines under the ground. You see, there's pipes everywhere throughout America right now, and the way we get our fuel from one place to the other is not by putting it in a big truck. It's much more efficient to pump it through pipes in the ground. It uses a lot less energy. We don't have to burn gas to move gas that way, all right? So that's how we, and then it goes to these regional distribution areas, and that's where it goes into trucks, and then it goes for very short distances to the fuel station. Problem is, you can't do that with ethanol. If you start pumping ethanol through pipes, first of all, it will destroy the pipeline infrastructure that we have because it's corrosive, far more corrosive than gas. Second of all, it breaks down in transport and picks up water, so it ruins it to pump it long distances. It doesn't store very well either, so it has to be produced and used very quickly compared to gasoline. So now, not only are we producing a fuel that takes 400 pounds of corn to a gallon, it takes 11 acres of land per individual per year to produce enough to be used to power cars. We also have a fuel that can't be transported without using trucks to get it transported because it can't go through our infrastructure that's designed to transport our fuel. You know, can this get worse? Yeah, it can get worse. It takes about 131,000 BTUs, British thermal units, the unit for measuring energy, to make a gallon of ethanol. When you add up all the heat to do the mashing, the tractor that has to plow the field, the fertilizer that goes to the field that's also made out of petroleum-based products, you add all that up, 131,000 BTUs. And a gallon of ethanol produces 77,000 BTUs. In other words, we lose about, what is that? That's 50,000 roughly BTUs of energy per gallon produced. It's a net loss, folks. We actually lose energy when we make ethanol. Now that's, you would think that that's as bad as it could get, but it's worse than that. Let's say that you're a big environmentalist and you say, you know what, the heck with all of this, you know, we're not pumping oil, we're not ruining the caribou's range. Or you're a big patriot, you say, you know what, I'd rather give the money to the farmers than the Arabs. Right? Either way. Here's something else you have to understand. Land-wise, we can't sustain this crop this way. Our land is not meant to produce this much corn. It just isn't. First of all, corn is what I call a land-intensive product. And if you talk to any farmer, any small-scale farmer, especially that has to do a lot of things by hand, I'll tell you that corn is one of the most intensive crops to grow. Give you an idea, corn erodes soil about 12 times faster than it can be reformed through natural processes. So you can't just keep growing corn out of the same piece of land over and over and over without bringing, trucking in dirt, trucking in organic matter, and trucking in fertilizer to replenish it. It destroys soil if it's not done in a more environmentally friendly way. It gets away from mass production to a little bit, at least. And it also sucks up water 25 times faster than water gets replenished. So you've got a crop that is using a tremendous amount of resources to produce a resource that eats resources to make more resources. So it's like a big vicious cycle here. This completely useless fuel, basically, is what we're ending up with, that loses energy in its very production. And this is what's going to save us from peak oil? This is what's going to save our environment? This is completely ridiculous. And again, I want to reiterate, it would take 97% of all the land in the United States to produce enough corn to completely fuel all of our vehicles with ethanol. It's just not reasonable to expect that we can do that. Now, let's look at it from a cost and economic side. All right? Do you know what it takes right now to produce a gallon of gas and ethanol mixture? Right, we're looking at the pump, and we see, I just paid $3.91, and I think gas was down a little bit this week for me here in Texas. I know plenty of people in Northeast are paying $4.05, $4.10 for regular right now. Well, that's just ridiculous. We're paying $4. Well, when you factor the ethanol into the mixture, how much ethanol? Because there's like 10% ethanol in all the gas now, because we have this mandate from the Fed that we have to use it, okay? But there's tremendous amounts of subsidies going to produce this stuff right now, because when you're producing something that's a loss leader, that loses energy, it also loses money. So the only way to get all these ethanol plants built and to get all this land farmed with this corn and to do these things are to offer subsidies. Those subsidies, when you add them in, we're actually paying about $6.89 a gallon right now. And I got that from Small Town Paper News as my source. So that's an actual hard figure. I want to source that. But if you go Google cost of ethanol per gallon, Small Town Paper News, you should be able to find that article and you can read it for yourself. So, you know, that's the real cost of ethanol. So this stuff costs a great deal. It's destroying our land and our resources. We can't transport it effectively. It uses more energy to produce a gallon of than a gallon produces back for us. There's just nothing good that I can find about this product, even in things like, well, it's carbon neutral. You know, okay, well, what that means is that, see, when you burn ethanol, it does release carbon. But since the corn plant itself took the carbon in the first place, you end up right back where you started, carbon neutral. There's X amount goes into the plant, Y amount comes back out. And burning that energy, we're staying right where we were. We're actually not producing any additional carbon in our atmosphere. Great. Well, that's if you ignore the fact you have to transport it by truck. It costs more to make in energy than it produces, that you have to use fertilizers, which are mostly made from natural gas, and on and on and on. When you put that back in, it's no longer carbon neutral. So I can't find anything good about it. Now, again, you'd go, okay, wow, man, this is a terrible idea. Why are we doing it? And surely it can't get any worse. Well, my friends, it can and does get worse. Because there's one thing that I haven't talked about yet with ethanol, and that is its effect on food supply and the pricing of food in the global market. Now, I'll apologize to you, but I don't have the exact figure. I think it's like 10 billion gallons. I could be wrong, but there's some huge number. of gallons of ethanol that we're required to use this year in the United States, and that number actually goes up next year by this federal mandate. That basically just says we will produce and use this much ethanol, and if the government has to throw money at it to make it happen, it's going to happen. This has driven up the price of corn. When you drive, now if you're a farmer and you could plant, let's say, wheat and make one profit, or you could plant corn and make a much bigger profit, the law of economics will take over and you're going to plant the corn. All right. So a lot of land that used to be used to produce wheat, let's say, that's just one crop, for instance, is now being used to produce corn. All right. Now, a lot of the land that was producing corn, at least, the corn was going into different foodstuffs. People don't realize how much stuff corn's in today. If it's sweetened in any way, and it comes in a box, it's probably sweetened with corn sugar. Because back in the 70s, the companies figured out that corn sugar, fructose syrup from corn, was a lot cheaper to sweeten with than cane sugar. Because corn can be grown in a lot larger scale, because sugar cane can only be grown in very specific types of climates. Alright, so everybody made that switch. So your corn is in all your foodstuffs, not just your corn chips and the things that obviously have corn. So that's put pressure on the food supply as a whole, because the price of corn goes up, the price of food must go up. But at the same time, these prices are forced up by simple economics, right? This isn't anything that anybody with economics 101 in high school couldn't understand. If demand increases, price rises. This is the most basic economic theory, and it's really not even a theory, that's a law. So we take now corn out of the food system at the same time. So not only do we have increasing demand just because of growth, but now we're actually shortening supply at the same time. Shorten supply economic theory. You short a supply, while demand increases, price goes up even more. Very simple to understand. Anybody gets this. In any free market in the world, you can understand that basic concept of the economy. But it's worse, because the other side of this is people that would grow other crops, other than corn, now stop growing those crops and start growing corn instead. Now the price of that food and that thing goes up. So that's what we're ending up. We're ending up with a situation where we're pulling food out of the food supply. We're using 11 acres of land that could be being used to produce food to produce fuel for one vehicle for 1 year. It's a reality. No matter how anybody says it, I don't care if it's a mixture of ethanol and gasoline, like 10% ethanol, you're still doing the same thing, because when you aggregate that 10% over 10 drivers, okay, you still used 11 acres for those 10 drivers, all right? So that's just the reality of what we're doing here. And the reality is corn-based ethanol can't work. It just can't work. It's not going to save us. And the biggest reason I wanted to do this podcast today is so if you become a believer in this stuff and you think that this is one of our solutions, I want you to realize that far from a solution, it's another one of our problems. And as one of our problems, it's something that you need to be preparing for the worst because of, rather than hoping and then see some salvation from. Now, a lot of times when I talk about this stuff, people go, well, you're just the evil man. You don't believe in it. You bought into the corporate propaganda, man, the oil companies, stuff like that. Now, listen, man, I am not a friend of the oil companies. I think the oil companies have been raping us for a long time. And the oil companies have been lying for us for a long time. And I think they have been suppressing technologies that could have alleviated the pressure on oil. I don't think they have the control of the price that some people think they do, or they would have never let the price of oil go through the floor in the 90s, okay? So it's not that I'm supporting the oil companies here. It's not that I'm opposed to figuring out other ways to produce energy. Okay, number one, what could work from a biofuel standpoint? Well, there's a couple crops that I think we need to be looking at how we can pull more ethanol from if we're going to make ethanol, despite all its other problems. If you want to, at least start with something that's more efficient. Remember, the process is you take grain, you mash it, you convert it to sugar. If you start with a crop that's already very sugary, it takes less energy to get it into sugar. Things like sugar beets and sugar cane. Now, the thing about sugar beets is they grow damn near anywhere. Now, you don't have a bunch of sugar beet lobbyists from Iowa and Indiana and places like that in Washington, so maybe that's the reason we haven't chosen them. But sugar beets is something we should probably look into. Sugar cane, the issue with that, again, is there's very little land in the United States that will actually support sugar cane agriculture at any real level. South Florida and South Louisiana and some other places, but very, very much only the most southern reaches of the United States in our somewhat tropical climates will even produce sugarcane. So now we have to go back to the fact that someone else controls our fuel supply, and that's an issue. But sugarcane, when you extract the juice from sugarcane, it's already sugar, folks. You don't have to mash it. You can go immediately to the fermentation and distillation processes. So both of those, and I'm sure there's other crops out there that are more efficient for making ethanol out of than corn. But the reality is we have an energy source that's really a perfect energy source. That energy source is electricity, right? I'm not giving you a full solution at the beginning because it's got to produce electricity, but just think about electricity as a whole. Once you actually have electricity, you can transport it anywhere you want to relatively easily over copper wires and cables, okay? It's completely clean once it is electricity. You might have to burn a fossil fuel to make it, but electricity is a very clean energy source. It is relatively inexpensive in the global market when you compare it to other sources of energy. If you actually have an electric car that works, you can run it for less than a gasoline vehicle. That's definitely the case. So electricity has a lot going for it. The problem is, how do we produce it? And this is where I think the environmentalists are in the way, and I think a lot of them want to see this economic collapse. They want us to go back to an agricultural-based society, whether people want that or not. Because the answer to this problem is, and you're going to gasp if you're an environmentalist, your nuclear power. And all of these guys that are very liberal in mindset, they go, we should be like Europe. We should be like Europe. Yeah, well, Europe builds the heck out of nuclear power plants. France generates nearly all of their electricity. You know those French people, those refined French people? They have nuclear power plants, nuclear reactors, right in the middle of their cities. All right? No one's blowing them up, and no kids are being born with giant tumors on their head. Nuclear power, especially the modern plants, and we haven't built one in this country since the 70s. So the modern power plants are very, very safe, very, very efficient, have a lot of fail safes that didn't exist when things like Three Mile Island and Chernobyl were created. So it's a very cheap source of power. It's a very very good source of power. And the nuclear waste everybody's worried about, if you add up, you know, you would think there's like billions of tons of nuclear waste out there. If you add up every ounce of nuclear waste that our government or our nation has produced, ever, it wouldn't fill one high school gymnasium. Again, I'm going to say that. It wouldn't fill one high school gymnasium. The way you get rid of nuclear waste is you dig a very deep hole surrounded by concrete and you bury it deep in the ground. And I think we need to be in touch with the fact also that we get nuclear power from uranium, and we take the uranium and we deplete it a great deal as we suck its energy out and we make it into a dangerous but less radioactive form by the time we're done with it. It's depleted, and we bury it back in the ground from whence it came. So all this uranium that you're worried about being in the ground is already out there. It's already in the ground. Nobody's going to make this stuff in a lab, folks. We got to go out there and get it. So it is an option. It's one that we need to consider. I'm also a big believer in solar and wind power. I think wind power actually is not being utilized anywhere near as much as it could be. I would be in favor of government programs that were designed to eventually transfer these things to private ownership. But let's say, let's start building some windmills along all this highway easement that we have all over the United States. All these open highways that tremendous amounts of wind cut through because of the way that they're built and the way that holes are cut in the woodlands through there. They create wind tunnels. I mean, that would be a great place. Or put solar panels out there. Let's just start building some power. If you look at it this way, our government spends $600 billion a year, $600 billion on our military-industrial complex, all right? More than all the other countries in the world combined. And I'm big on defending our nation, but folks, we don't need to spend $600 billion to do it. We could $1 billion a year, $1 billion, one six-hundredth of the total spend. And we used it to $1 billion a year spent building power generation equipment that we then sold at fair market rates from the government to the power companies. You can't do anything but build and produce energy with this. No bureau, very thin organization. It never happened the way our government runs. I know that I'm being idealistic here. But if we did that, and we had done that every year since, let's say, 1970, see, one of the things that happened is the economy of scale would have kicked in by now, and the cost of doing this stuff would have gone down. We've been producing major, major amounts of electricity from all of this equipment that would already be deployed and out there. Those would be a lot further ahead. So those are some answers to the energy problem. I just wanted to kind of, you know, give you some things to think about with energy today and realize that this this biofuel thing is really a disaster. And again, I'm always looking for new topics and new subjects, so that's going to kind of wrap today's show up. If you have any suggestions or ideas, please comment on the blog. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. You can comment on this particular episode. And again, I hope you have a great day, and I hope you're getting prepared for whatever may come your way and figuring out how to live the life you want, whether times get tough or even if they don't.
You can scream and you can holler. It really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.